tired you.
I will open the Senate Committee on Rules for June 17th, 2009. I'm going to start off by opening a work session, which will actually be a little bit more like a public hearing. And we have two panels that are going to be coming up. The first panel, Mr. Dave Vanhoff, Bob Austin, Chris Hager, Bomber, phonetically here, Marion Hayes. Yes. Now, I give each panel 20 minutes in total. You divide it up however you want to divide it up. But at 20 minutes, I'm going to end the panel. So that means at about 2 minutes after two. I don't think she's testifying.
Short and sweet. You just gave away 40 minutes. We haven't done nothing.
I know.
What are you doing, brother?
This is the plan from yesterday. So just go ahead, identify yourself for the record, and start.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dave Antoff from the governor's office for the record, and I'll just be really brief. The governor supports the B. Engross amendments that were discussed yesterday. We look at them as a workable compromise that went through many layers of negotiation and compromise as the journey of the bill through the House and now through the Senate. And just wanted to highlight again why the governor feels strongly that this is an important piece of legislation to move forward. Really three things that we think the bill does. One, it will, of all the bills that are still under consideration this session, it'll have the most significant impact on greenhouse gas reductions and combating climate change, which is an overarching goal of the legislation. But as importantly, the governor believes that it will create jobs and spur economic opportunities in Oregon. We've heard, I think you'll hear and have heard in testimony on the bill in the past from entities like Oregon Business Association, technology investors, and companies like Zeachem, who make cellulosic ethanol, who all look at this as a jobs creator and an opportunity for technology investment in Oregon. And third, that we think long-term this is actually a savings bill for consumers at the pump, that as the price of gasoline goes up and up over the terms of this low-carbon fuel standard, which is looking at a 2020 window, and the costs of these new fuels come down and down, it's a net win for consumers at the pump as well. So it's a jobs bill, it's a consumer bill, and it's a climate change bill that will collectively have a really significant impact for Oregon. Thank you.
Chair Dibble and committee members, I'm Vice Chair Robert Austin of the Clackamas County Commission. Seems like I was just here last week on another issue, but what I've included in terms of an item is something that our Chair Lynn Peterson sent to Senator Jackie Dingfelder back in about a later part of May 2009, supporting what was the 2186A version of this bill. And I think the new version is still, pretty much intact, and I think a lot of the items that were highlighted in the bullet points in Chair Peterson's letter are still valid today. Clackamas County is very active in terms of green government initiatives. We have a sustainability department. We're trying to integrate sustainable practices all through our governmental parts of our county administration, as well as all of our departments. So we feel that this bill is still worthwhile for us in terms of helping to limit Oregon's greenhouse gas emissions, and especially the standards that are outlined in the current version. We also believe that we've also signed on with some of the other counties in the state in terms of the Cool County Initiative to help reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 80% by 2050. We believe this bill will put us towards reaching those types of goals. So, again, we're really strongly in support of this bill in terms of the Clackamas County Commission. So, thank you.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Chris Hager-Baumer. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Environmental Council. We're here today to support House Bill 2186. improving energy efficiency and shifting away from the carbon-based fuels of the past that cause global warming will create good new jobs for Oregonians and save consumers and businesses money. We think that Oregon can either lead and take advantage of this shift or miss the boat as other states act more quickly. We think that the strategies outlined in HB 2186 are common sense. They don't come out of the blue. They've been studied for years. This bill embodies what we think is an appropriate distinction between the legislative and the regulatory functions of the state, giving DEQ the direction and giving DEQ the authority to just get through the technical details of these strategies. And we think that DEQ really takes that requirement seriously and ensures rigorous involvement. We do regret the fact that this bill has been watered down significantly, and we hope you will still consider strengthening it a bit before it moves to the floor. The low-carbon fuel standard, which would require the transportation fuels to be the mix of fuel sold into the state to be reduced, the carbon intensity to be reduced by 10% by 2020, is really doable. If fuel providers start now, that means only 1% per year by 2020. And this has a lot of other benefits besides the global warming benefits. It will help grow Oregon's clean energy industry, from electric vehicle manufacturing to cellulosic biofuels. It will discourage unclean energy investments like fuel from coal to liquids and oil produced from tar sands and oil shale. And it will reduce our dependence on imported oil, which keeps more money in the state. And it will reduce our sensitivity, our economy's sensitivity to oil price uncertainty and shocks that are occurring due to refinery outages and so on. We are very concerned about the fact that Section 8 repeals the low-carbon fuel standard as of 2015, because that doesn't exactly send the right signal to the market. And I wonder if businesses will actually locate elsewhere that are going to be producing these fuels. Moving on to the reducing aerodynamic drag of heavy-duty trucks and reducing unnecessary idling, these are great steps to move forward on. We understand that this has been turned into a study rather than rulemaking. And I just wanted to point out that at the very least, I think we should consider getting the anti-idling standards back as rulemaking. I outlined here a number of states that already have statutes related to anti-idling. And I will count them, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, like 17 or 18 other states already have statutes on the book. And I really wonder why we would take a back seat, what I consider to be a polluted back seat, to those other states. We're pleased that there are still a couple of other things in the bill, including the preventing tampering with emission control systems and ensuring proper tire inflation. There are a couple of other things that dropped out, but basically our main message today is that it's important to pass this bill, and we urge you to still consider making it a bit stronger before passing it to the floor, and thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. And now if the fourth party would come forward and...
And may I add that Sequential Biofuels actually was able to come today, and they could speak to that clean energy piece.
Yes, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. My name is Marion Haynes. I'm with the Oregon Business Association. OBA believes that we are moving into a carbon-constrained environment and that we do need to take steps to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. Ideally, we prefer a comprehensive federal approach to this, but that being said, we think that Oregon can and should take steps now, and that will get us ahead of the curve on some of these things that are obviously headed our way. We had a committee that took a look at this bill and recommended that OBA support the bill, which we do. A lot of the reasons behind that was driving innovation and new markets and new jobs in Oregon. We did work with folks as the bill was being amended to make sure that the economic impacts to Oregon's economy is taken into consideration, and feel like some of those elements have now been included in the direction to DEQ as they move forward with developing the rules for the low-carbon fuel standards. So, again, OBA is in support of this. We think it will do a lot for Oregon to get us ahead of the ball and be a leader in this area as all of these things are coming at us at the federal level. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any questions for any of the panelists? Senator Ferriola.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this is a question for Mr. Vantoff or perhaps others. If I could please ask you to characterize Oregon's carbon footprint relative to the other 50 states?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrioli, in terms of do we have a higher or lower footprint, carbon footprint?
Yes, please.
The I couldn't say in terms of the 50 states, but I would say that because of our hydro system and some of our energy mix, that we have a lower carbon footprint than many states in the country. In the transportation fuels sector, I don't have comparative numbers. I would guess that we're up there with I don't know if ODOT or anyone can add to that, but I would guess we're have a significant carbon footprint in the transportation fuel sector as most states, whether all. I doubt, because of our land use system, that it's going to be as high as some. So, but I don't. We can get those numbers, but I don't have.
Mr. Chairman, Oregon has a carbon footprint of 42nd in the nation out of 50 states. Do you have an idea of what the total amount of carbon emitted in Oregon is?
My agencies do. I don't personally. I can get you that number too. I'm guessing you have it there, though.
Mr. Chair, it's 40.5 million tons. Do you know where we are in terms of relative population among the 50 states?
I would guess that we're fairly low on that number.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, we're 28th in population among the states. So as a state with a 28th position in population has the 42nd position in carbon emissions. Do you have any idea of what it would cost us to move to the 43rd position?
I do not have that.
No one knows, as a matter of fact, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman, my understanding from asking carbon scientists about this is that if we did move from 42nd to 43rd, I asked if that would be quantifiable or measurable in the region, and the answer is no. I asked if it would be carbon quantifiable in the U.S. Would it be a noticeable difference, a change more than a rounding error? And the answer is no. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay.
Any additional questions for this panel? If not, thank you very much. I will next go on to the next panel. Mr. Bob Russell, Mr. Brian Dougherty, Sandy Flicker, and Ms. Katie Fast.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Brian Dougherty. I'm here testifying on behalf of the Western States Petroleum Association, wearing my finest green outfit, hopefully in hopes of understanding that we do believe in some measures taken to get to greenhouse gas reductions. You have before you today in 2186 of the B-20 amendments, after all has been cleared away, a low-carbon fuel standard. I ask you, what is a low-carbon fuel standard? No one has defined it. What you're doing today is giving DEQ the full authority to define that and come up with what you have for a plan. It is giving them full authority to do this. Let's go back to 2007. We thought we had a low-carbon fuel standard in 2007. We passed the renewable fuel standard. That was ethanol. We promised that we'd have rich farmers, that we'd have a booming, vibrant ethanol manufacturing industry. We'd lower our fuel's carbon footprint and our dependence on foreign oil. What do we have today? No rich farmers, two ethanol plants in bankruptcy, a possibly higher carbon footprint with E10, no significant reductions in foreign oil, and worse miles per gallon, all at an increased cost to Oregon motorists. Maybe if we studied that issue, we would have seen what was coming. The messages and the signs were there in 2007. The ASHB 20 has no study. What did we learn for 2009? Apparently, studies began full speed ahead on the next environmental cause du jour, LCFS. I don't mean to demean it. It is one option in a pathway to 2020 greenhouse gas reduction goals. We think it's the worst of the options that you have to look at. There are no studies in here that says that DEQ in Section 6-3 shall evaluate. That is not determining the economic impact of a greenhouse gas reduction strategy on Oregonians. Neither is evaluating other state studies. They simply say they shall evaluate. Should we not ask what the pathway is best for Oregon to achieve its 2020 goals? How does low carbon fuel standard compare to a carbon tax or a cap and trade system? There's no assessment of an alternative to meet Oregon's greenhouse gas reduction goals in these amendments. This is ready, fire, aim legislation. Washington's executive order. We've heard much about the Washington that Washington will be adopting a low carbon fuel standard effective July 2010. In fact, what the executive order 0905 says is that the Department of Ecology shall, in consultation with the Department of Commerce and Transportation, assess whether the California LCFS from or other states, provinces, or national standards or alternative requirements to reduce carbon and fuels would best meet Washington's greenhouse gas reduction targets. In fact, it says that by July 2010, they will report back to the governor on their recommendation. Thereafter, if they elect to proceed by rule, they have not decided whether they will proceed by rule or by legislation. If they proceed by rule, the Department of Ecology estimates it will be 18 to 24 months as a result of the complexity of the fuels and the result of their APA requirements to get there. I call your attention to an email I received today that is page 3 of my testimony. It is an email from Janice Adair of the Washington Department of Ecology expressing what their timetable is and what questions that are still remaining. And they're indicating there is no chance of an LCFS in Washington in 2010. We offered compromise language, four things. We asked for federal preemption. We asked for a bi-state study with Washington. We asked for that you do not adopt a standard unless it's commercially available in Oregon. And we asked that the RFS be discontinued if the LCFS was adopted. Not any of those are in the bill. What about the California LCFS? That is what you heard DEQ testify, that they are drafting rules based on the California LCFS. We do not get fuels from California. We get them from Washington, 85 to 90%. In closing, we ask you to convert HB 2186 to a bill that directs DEQ to coordinate a study with Washington as our best option to obtain 2020 greenhouse gas reductions. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. For the record, Katie Fast, Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. Oregon Farm Bureau opposes 2186 with the B20 amendments that were put in yesterday. Our concern comes with the low carbon fuel standard that is developed in the bill. While there is an exemption in section 6 sub 4 for the farm community, farm vehicles, tractors, and implements of husbandry, Farm Bureau still does not believe that this exemption will truly apply to our farmers and ranchers. Our concern lies with the availability of regular fuel that is not the low carbon standard in the state. A typical farm operation will use three types of fuel, regular gas, on-road diesel, and off-road diesel. We are very concerned that at regular fuel in those three categories will be available to farm and ranches to purchase. I would say our members are concerned that they will run into the same barriers they're running to with the ethanol exemptions for small engines and the availability of finding non-ethanol fuel currently. Additionally, about 80% of Oregon agriculture is exported out of the state, and the real economic opportunities for farms and ranchers is through that exportation. That happens on commercial trucks, not on F-plated vehicles that would be exempt through this legislation. And you will hear concerns from the trucking industry later on the panel. Oregon Farm Bureau is extremely supportive of the development of biofuels in the state, and we're part of the legislation bringing the renewable fuel standard last session. We believe that there are opportunities to develop cellulosical ethanol in the state. Some of that's moving forward in the Boardman area. We feel like there are opportunities for the state to partner in projects around the Eugene area to use grass straw for biofuels and for ethanol. However, the low carbon fuel standard is moving too quick There's too many left questions on exactly what that means and what it'll mean for Oregon's farmers and ranchers. We support the legislature moving in a glide path along with Washington to study this, bring recommendations and economic impacts forward in the next legislative session to make a decision by legislators, not DEQ, on our fuel supply. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sandy Flicker. I'm here today representing the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association and the Oregon PUD Association. I have passed out a map to the committee that I would appreciate it if you take a quick look at. I think it is a good reminder of what small rural utilities have to face. As you can see, we serve 65% of the state geographically, but only about 11% of the population. It costs a tremendous amount of money to maintain our systems, and there are very, very few people there to pay for that cost. Also, because of the vastness of the systems, we travel many, many, many miles. Harney Electric Cooperative, who has one of the largest service territories in not only Oregon, but in the country, also serves into Nevada. They travel over 1 million miles a year. We have to travel very, very long distances to maintain these kinds of service territories, which means that our fuel costs for both the co-ops and the PUDs are over 30% of our budget. So fuel costs are an incredibly important issue to rural utilities and to rural communities in general. In rural communities, also, I just want to remind you that folks have to travel great distances just to live in rural communities. As I know, I'm not giving Senator Farioli anything new. The travel is incredibly long. And so fuel use is incredibly high. We do not have public transit in most of the communities that we serve, and it's unlikely that we're going to have electric cars in the near future. So we are faced with having to use a lot of fuel, and anything that appears as if it's going to increase fuel costs becomes very, very concerning to rural folks. We've maintained a position throughout the legislative session that we believe it is not appropriate to for the legislature to give DEQ the authority to write the climate change rules. We, in fact, think this ought to be a legislative decision. And we also have maintained throughout the session that we think it is in Oregon's best interest to follow federal climate change activity instead of precede it. We have a history of unintended consequences, and I think you heard from Mr. Doherty some of those unintended consequences. Sometimes policies that are created in this state have unintended consequences. That has happened in the energy world. Deregulation had many, many costly unintended consequences. We would really advise that study is the better approach to make sure that we can at least diminish or minimize the unintended consequences, because they come at a very, very, very high cost. And something like this could come at a very, very high cost to rural Oregonians. Appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today and to share our concerns about increasing fuel costs for not only our small utilities but our small communities. Thank you very much.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell, president of the Oregon Trucking Associations. And first, I would like to thank the committee for the work that you've already done on this bill. We very much appreciate that you've turned the truck-specific items into a study instead of moving those towards implementation. However, the centerpiece of this bill was and continues to be the low-carbon fuel standard. Fuel is obviously the lifeblood of the trucking industry. You've heard now from several witnesses that the low-carbon fuel standard is a very broad delegation of authority to the Department of Environmental Quality. We really don't know what the result will be. What's particularly concerning is the subsection C on page 6 of the amendments that basically says the DEQ can change the goal, can change the standards, can change the whole program based on what is adopted in other states. So even what we do have in this bill may not be what we end up with depending on what other states adopt and what DEQ adopts from those other states. Yes, there are some sideboards in this bill, But those cyborgs are very subjective. The only objective standard is the 10% reduction, which can change depending on what other states do. I think the thing that's most telling is Mr. Ginsburg's testimony from yesterday, when he said that the low carbon fuel standard basically remains unchanged except for the sunset date. So the sideboards really have not changed the way the agency is looking at this bill. So from our perspective, we still don't know what the end result is going to be, because fuel is so important to us, it concerns us a great deal. Second point I'd like to make is that I have the fiscal from the be engrossed version of this bill. That's all that's available on the internet as of today. What the fiscal indicates is that DEQ intends to dedicate 1 1/4 FTE to this bill, and that's all aspects of this bill. From our perspective, they are not being provided adequate resources to do the job. When we heard this bill first in the Senate and the House Environment Committee, the committee contacted the California Air Resources Board by phone and asked them about their low-carbon fuel standard effort. They have had 130 people working for a number of years to develop their low-carbon fuel standard. Dedicating 1 1/4 FTE for Oregon's low-carbon fuel standard appears to us to be woefully inadequate. When we first implemented the ethanol requirement, I was watching the 6 o'clock news, and they were interviewing a young lady in Portland. This was at the gas station, and they were asking her questions about how she felt about having ethanol added to her gasoline and the reduction in the miles per gallon that she would achieve, although technically that's very minuscule. But she was absolutely outraged that the government would require ethanol in her gasoline would reduce her miles per gallon, even a small amount, increasing the cost of her driving. The public is very concerned about the cost of these things. When we look at what we've really got here, we're talking about a 10% reduction. That's the goal. My understanding is with 10% ethanol, corn-based ethanol that we import from the Midwest, if you look at it on a life cycle basis, as required in this bill, we're saving about 1% carbon. In order to meet the 10%, you would have to have 10 times the current requirement for ethanol, which I think would be 100% ethanol. Well, we don't have enough farmland in this country to grow the corn to produce that kind of ethanol. Instead of we would be reducing our reliance on foreign oil, but in fact we would be increasing our reliance on foreign food, because we would be using all of our farmland for fuel. Of course, we're not going to go there, but this bill would in fact allow us to go there. But the goal is not just a 10% reduction. The goal is a 10% reduction from 2010 off of 2010 levels by 2020. If we figure a 2% increase in fuel consumption per year from 2010 to 2020, that's 20%. You add that to the 10% reduction, what we're really asking DEQ to do is reduce 30% of the carbon by 2020. I don't believe that there is any fuel that's commercially available today or technologically feasible that can actually achieve that goal. I don't want the committee to think that we don't believe in global warming. We do. And I don't want the committee to think that the trucking industry doesn't recognize that we have a role to play in reducing our carbon footprint. We do. What I'm concerned about is that we're going forward without knowing what we're doing, without understanding what we're doing. And what I would urge the committee to do is vote no and turn this bill into a study where we can come back in 2011, we can be informed, we can make knowledgeable decisions, and we can move forward with reducing carbon in Oregon's environment. That concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Any questions for this panel? Senator Metzger.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Russell, first I want to clarify one thing. Your last comment about talking about increased population or fuel use and, you know, could be 30%. The way the bill is written on page 5 of the amendment, line 21, is that the schedule for 10% reduction by 2010 levels to 20 is per unit of fuel energy, not for how much energy totally is used in the state. It's per unit. So regardless of how much more people may be driving or whatever, it's still that per unit. So I just want to clarify that. It's not the amount of fuel consumed in the state to reduce the carbon. Ms. Flicker, I want to ask you a question because I know you talked about you're concerned about the miles and the fuel costs, and I think that's legitimate. I think we're all concerned about that. On page 6 of the bill, in terms of the standards that would have to be put together, some of those sideboards we talked about, the Commission shall provide exemptions and deferrals to mitigate costs of complying with the low-carbon fuel standards upon a finding at the Commission that the 12-month rolling weighted average price of gasoline or diesel in Oregon is not competitive with the 12-month rolling weighted average in the PADD 5 region or the 5-state region. So help me understand, when you're talking about the fuel cost, we're all concerned about that. But part of the sideboard is that our fuel costs can't be way out of line with our neighbors anyway. So I want to dig a little bit deeper into why you don't see that as a sideboard for different fuel costs.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, I guess what the point I was attempting to make was the disproportionate impact on rural Oregon because of the number of miles that we have to, that they have to travel in rural Oregon as opposed to someone who has the availability of public transit, the availability of going to the grocery store a couple blocks away. So that's the point that I was attempting to make in my testimony. I appreciate the fact that there are sideboards in here. The sideboards in here, frankly, do not cover all of our concerns with the bill.
Thank you. And then, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I had one actually for Mr. Daugherty, if he could come back up. Mr. Daugherty, and you're here representing the petroleum, which, the Northwest Petroleum?
Western States Petroleum.
Okay. I just, maybe if you could help me for a little bit. Some clippings I put together. As you know, California has adopted standard, not yet been implemented. You know, in April they took that first step, and there's been comments about the California standard. But in the LA Times, April 24, 2009, James Uhlein of Chevron endorsed the standard and says, quote, sending the right signal to innovators, produce advanced fuels. Graham S. Sweeney, Shell executive vice president, said, they endorse the standards. There will be a series of commercial-sized plants in the next 5 years. There will be different technology. It will be good to see competition. And in the AP, Associated Press, April 23, 2009, represents for BP, PLC, and Chevron said their companies support the new low-carbon fuel standards with the caveat that the board periodically review the standards. So I'm just trying to understand, because you represent a bunch of petroleum, and those are some of the big boys, why they are supporting a California standard, you know, and why then the Western States Petroleum would be against supporting a standard here.
Chair Devlin and Senator Metzger, I represent a consortium of oil companies in there. I have not read the article. I know that some of them, since California has adopted it, have decided to move forward with the California standard. They have been uniformly opposed to a low-carbon fuel standard outside of California in other states. We do not share our fuels with California. And I think what they're doing is trying to make the best of what they have with a low-carbon fuel standard that's already been passed. But they have been uniform, including BP and Chevron, in opposing low-carbon fuel standards in other states.
Can I ask another question, Mr. Chair?
Yes. Yes.
In the industry, I think you've stated before that, round figures anyway, about 90% of our petroleum comes from Washington that's sold here in Oregon. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So putting aside this bill at the moment, I mean, in terms of whatever the state of Washington's refining capacity, and I know there'll be other, the potential for mixing other fuels, et cetera, to meet different standards, that in all likelihood, whatever, say, the state of Washington does on this issue, and we don't know what that all is, but whatever it is, would you say that would have likely have a tremendous influence on the supplies and the quality of those supplies that we will be purchasing here in Oregon?
Chair Devlin, Senator Metzger, I'm not sure I understand. Are you saying that Washington refineries have an influence on the quality of fuels in Oregon?
No, I mean, I'm talking about everything, because part of the thing about the low-carbon fuel standard is maintaining quality and everything else in terms of what may be mixed with it. I'm just saying is that with whatever proceeds in the future with the state of Washington and then the providing of the fuels from the refineries there in Washington, whatever that is, isn't that likely to have a tremendous influence on this, a like or similar product that would be at least initially distributed here in Oregon?
Chair Devlin, Senator Metzger, I believe so. It depends on what your options are. I mean, electric vehicles are something different. A biodiesel blending at the terminal would be something done in Oregon. A biodiesel blended at the refinery certainly would have that effect. So I think it depends on what you're doing, but I think we are very much tied to Washington in terms of our fuels.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any additional questions? Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the work session on 2186. I think there is very little chance that I will be coming back to this bill today, but I will not give you a guarantee that I will not. Because we are waiting on fiscal statements. Okay, I'm going to go directly to HJR 13. That's simply a work session. And while we do that, can I get the Senator Boquist here? Because we'll go to 2827 right after that. But I'll preserve your minority report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
He was very kind about that.
Just love minority reports. Just
what we live for, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to do a bill first, but I need...
Okay.
Ted needs you. No, but we need you.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. I've opened a work session on HJR 13A. Do we have a motion? First of all, can the committee administrator give a brief overview?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. HJR 13A was heard on June 2nd. We had a public hearing, and what it does is, upon approval by the people at the May 2010 primary election, it revises the Oregon Constitution to exempt local taxing districts from constitutional limitations on bonded indebtedness beginning January 1, 2011, if bonded indebtedness is incurred to finance capital costs. There is a fiscal statement issued on the measure, and it is in your packet.
Okay, do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I feel a little duplicitous here. Since I intend to offer a minority report, I need to vote no on the main measure.
I'll be happy to make the motion, Mr. Chair.
Senator Metzger.
I move House Joint Resolution 13A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Metzger has moved House Joint Resolution 13A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Senator Boquist.
No.
Senator Burdick.
Aye.
Senator Metzger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Farioli.
No.
Chair Devlin.
Aye. Motion passes. I will carry Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, serve notice for a potential minority report.
Okay.
Possible.
You do realize that an HJR is
20 votes, sir.
Yes,
I do realize that.
Yeah, and an HDR is a constitutional amendment, so
it is,
virtually
sir.
Any minority report can be put in this that is constitutional.
Yes, it's a wide open minority report, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
And we're going to go to a bill that I think is interesting to some other members.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Do you want to?
No, we're good.
Work session is over. Would you like? Okay. We will be at ease for just a few minutes. A work session on House Bill 2827. We are in a work session, but I'm going to ask Representative Olson to come forward. I do not know if Senator George is available.
Senator George's legislative aide is
here. Okay.
And I'd like
okay.
to join them at the podium for the record, if you would, Mr. Chair.
Yes, that would be fine, Senator Boakley. If you can give a brief overview, and then we'll just give the brief overview.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2827 extends the statute of limitations for actions based on child abuse, provides that an action must commence before the victim reaches age of 40 or within 5 years from the date the victim discovers causal connection between the injury and abuse, whichever is longer, applies retroactively unless judgment is entered. It comes to you from your Senate Committee on Judiciary.
Yes, Representative Olson, since you've been over...
Did you want
to... I'll leave, Mr. Chair. Thank you. For the record, Brian Boakwitz, Vice Chair of Judiciary. We heard this bill in Judiciary, and there was a tremendous amount of testimony in discussions with the chief proponent of the bill in reviewing it. We think we've made some improvements to it to ensure that we extend the statute of limitations of the original intent that we intended for the bill. And with that, I would apologize that Senator George is driving madly back here. He is very supportive of this, and very briefly his LA will convene that, and I think he will actually mention that. I apologize for missing the meeting on the floor later today, Mr. Chair.
And Senator Boakwitz, he's both supportive of the bill and supportive
absolutely.
Of the amendment that's going to be offered.
Totally in support, Senator George's, and I will let his LA convey that too.
For the record, my name is Henry O'Keefe, and I am one of Senator George's LAs. And I would like to reiterate what Senator Boakwitz said, that Senator George is, in fact, supporting the bill and the amendments and apologizes for not being here himself.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Andy Olson. I'm a state representative out of the Albany area. And not to go into great detail what House Bill 2827 is, like Senator Boakwitz had mentioned, the Judiciary Committee had heard that and moved it to your place. Now, if you want me to go into great detail about what the bill does and everything.
Well, you might do briefly and then
okay.
Talk about the Dash 12.
Okay. Basically what it does, Mr. Chair, committee members, it changes the civil statute of limitations for actions based on conduct that constitutes child abuse or conduct, knowingly allowing, permitting, or encouraging child abuse. And additionally, this bill requires that an action must be commenced before a claimant attains 40 years of age, or not more than 5 years from the date the claimant discovered or in exercise of reasonable care should have discovered that this occurred. Now, what the Dash 12 does is removes Section 1, Sub 2 that goes into great detail of what the definitions of causal connection is and also injury. And basically what we'll be doing with that is what the courts have found that apply toward that area rather than to place it in statute.
Okay. Any questions for any of the parties testifying? Seeing none, thank you all for coming here today, and thank you, Representative Olson. And
thank you.
Senator Boakwitz, give him time to rejoin us here at the podium.
I can move quick, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we are in work session on 2827. Senator Ferrioli, do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, move the Dash 12 amendments to House Bill 2827.
Okay. Senator Ferrioli has moved the Dash 12 amendments to 2827. Could the committee administrator just give a very brief overview of the Dash 12 amendment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The Dash 12 amendments deletes the definitions of causal connections between injury and child abuse.
Okay. Senator Ferrioli has moved the Dash 12 amendments. Is there any discussion? Any additional discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, motion passes. Do we have a motion on the main bill as now is amended?
Mr. Chairman, move House Bill 2827 to the floor with a due pass mm-hmm. recommendation mm-hmm. as amended. Oh. Let me back up, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we were unable to get the fiscal statement back on the Dash 12. We do have the no revenue statement. The amendment should not change the minimal fiscal that the bill came to us with, so we would need to suspend the rules to move the bill today.
Senator Ferrioli.
Mr. Chairman, I move we suspend rules for the purpose of considering HB 2827 without the updated fiscal impact statement.
Okay. Senator Ferrioli has moved that the rules be suspended for the purpose of voting on HB 2827 is now amended without the fiscal impact statement being available for review.
Any discussion, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
If the fiscal impact statement catches the bill and is more than minimal, then we have the assurance of the chair that we could move the bill back to the committee for reconsideration. But
Senator Farioli, the chair will do everything possible, but at this stage of the session, if the bill is going to move, we may not be able to move it back.
And, Mr. Chairman, in view of the fact that what we're doing is narrowing the scope of the bill, I think that will be a high likelihood that the fiscal impact will be negligible. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Motion stands.
Okay. Any additional discussion? Any objection to the motion? Motion passes. Now, do we have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, move HB 2827 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Farioli has moved HB 2827 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, motion passes. I will carry, and so we'll co-carry with Senator Farioli. That concludes that work session.
Yeah.
We will now open a public hearing on, do we have Representative Roebland here yet?
No, not here.
Okay. I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3106. And can the committee administrator give a brief overview?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 3106B creates an 11-member task force on nearshore research. It directs the task force to make recommendations to ensure protection and utilization of Oregon's nearshore resources. You will see the -B12 amendments. They increase task force to 14 members, as a member, director of Department of State Lands, or designee, changes membership composition to allow one member to represent sport fishers or the fishing industry, one member to represent nearshore industry or other fishing industry, as one member representing nearshore recreation other than fishing. We do have a fiscal statement on the -B12 and a no revenue impact statement on the -B12.
Okay. Representative Roebland is not here, so I'm going to call up some of the other people to testify. Mr. Ed Bowles and Mr. Joe Rolander. If you start at your leisure, and as soon as Representative Roebland is here, I'll invite him up to the table also.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Ed Bowles. I'm the Fish Division Administrator for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Representative Roebland is not able to make it here, isn't certain if he's going to make it here, and so he asked me to go ahead and provide some background on this bill and convey his hope for support. House Bill 3106 is to develop a task force to help coordinate and secure kind of the coordination and the funding for long-term research in the nearshore. We have a lot of issues that are facing the nearshore marine resources. I've already talked to you about the marine reserve issues, but in addition to that, there's marine aquaculture, energy development, mineral extraction, and federal initiatives. It's very important that we have good information to make informed management decisions. That's really what this is about. There's been several federal and non-federal efforts to coordinate research, but the state has not really pulled this together into a fashion that then we can make priorities and decisions on funding. And so the purpose of this is to create a task force that would use this next year to pull available information together, help establish those priorities, and then also discuss and make recommendations on a vehicle for pursuing funding for those priorities, and also a way to develop transparency in the coordination among marine agencies within the state. That includes some way of having certain public involvement so that transparency is clear, and also clarity on how those funds that will be pursued and secured, how those will be used to promote nearshore information. So that's the basis of the bill. The bill also tries to be representational and including a cross-section of both scientific and ocean user interest groups. And you can see from the bill the makeup of that. There are some amendments for your committee to consider that include some additional members to the committee to round out that, you know, breadth of representation and diversity. It also is an amendment to change fishermen to fishers. So that's the bill in a nutshell. I can certainly answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rollator. I live in Walport, Oregon. I'm here today representing the People Bay Charter Boat Association. We support this bill. We think that the nearshore area is the part of the ocean that people interact with the most. And those of us who spend a lot of our lives on the ocean realize there's really very little research that's been done about this area. There are always new things that I learn almost every time I go out in the ocean. I see new things and I try to understand how things work. So I think this is a monumental task, and I'm really glad we're finally going to address overall coordinated ocean research, nearshore ocean research. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the panel? I do have a question about the fiscal. The fiscal indicates that the approximate $100,000 for the 0911 biennium, $45,000 for personal services, and $55,000 for travel reimbursements will be expended through the Department of Higher Education from their other funds budget, but at present no source of funding has been identified. So tell me about the implementation strategy without the source of funding identified and with at least a $100,000 upfront price tag and then another departmental FTE 0.25 of a natural resource specialist at about $48,000. How does that all go together?
Chair Devlin, Vice Chair Ferrioli, thank you for bringing that up, because I should have mentioned that. The funding for this currently would be empty limitation. We would have to pursue monies to do this through the Department of Higher Education that would come in primarily just to staff the task force and provide some limited resources for the travel and for the meetings, and then coordinate the information into a report. That's where that FTE would come in. And so it is totally dependent on that funding, which is not secured at this time. And they're currently pursuing, until this passes, of course, there won't be anything officially pursued, but they're exploring interest for funding of the effort.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, any additional questions?
Yes.
Okay. There is another chairman. Question, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
LCDC, can you explain what the role of the LCDC will be in the nearshore study?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ferrioli, yes, as part of the what is loosely termed the Marine Cabinet Agencies, natural resource type agencies. Each one has different jurisdictions and authorities in the marine environment, of which Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, for example, has jurisdiction over the fish and wildlife resources. Land components, different agencies have jurisdiction. Parks has some jurisdiction. And that is why this position is in there, to represent those authorities.
Mr. Chairman, could this be, so will LCDC play a coordinating role among these different agencies?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrioli, they will be a part of the task force, and so all of them will be developing a mechanism to coordinate nearshore resource. This group will actually not be doing that coordination. This task force is charged with really just developing the sort of framework that would then come out as a recommendation for how to better coordinate nearshore research and management.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Roland, would you like to speak to
the bill? I would love to. Thank you. This is a bill that I have actually been working on for about, well, my three sessions here. It was one of the ones I had first talked about because my concern is we have not done research on the coast to the extent that we should to have an understanding of what we're trying to do, whether it be ocean reserves or just the fish that we harvest. Do we have surveys? And so, and every time we do research, everybody complained about who did the research and where the money came from for the research, which divided how the research was. So the last interim, I worked with a number of people from the Oregon State University over at Newport to talk about how do we come up with the kind of structure that we need to have to make sure that the research that comes out of money we're going to spend as a state and others is research that we can all agree on, at least have an understanding of it. So what this bill was trying to do was get a group of people together who will have an input to come up with what do we want for a nearshore research institute. And that means, from my perspective, they're going to talk about when you go gather up information and it comes out of this research institute, you're going to be expected to show all the protocols you used, we hope, use fishermen and others that are on the coast to do that, and then how do those protocols be replicated so that at the end of the day, all of your data is going to be available to other scientists so they can look at it and say, oh yeah, we come to the same conclusions because here's how it was gathered and so on. And so who should be, at some point in the future, that group that helps determine what pieces of where we spend our money, does the RFPs, does all that kind of stuff. And so what we're doing is bringing a group of people together who I believe eventually will be the people who find resources to send to this research institute that then says we're going to send out an RFP because this is the research we need to know on the coast, whether it's some little critter that lives out there or whether it's some more seafloor mapping or whatever it is. And that group's going to say, here's the criteria, here's the stuff that we need to, the information we want, here's the question we want answered, here's an RFP. Other people in the community will bid on that RFP. They'll go and produce it, whether it's the University of Oregon, Oregon State, or some private group. That research will come back. It'll be owned by us. And so at the end of the day, we'll have a better idea what's going on in that nearshore area. And that until we have a real conversation amongst all the players about what kind of research we want to gather, how we're going to do that, we haven't been able to move forward. And every time I've brought it up, there have been so many people who want a part of it that it always kind of died because they all fought with each other. So I said, why don't we put them all together in a room and agree on how do we go about organizing this stuff for the future. So that's, to me, what this bill is about. It's not about what research we're going to do. It's not about telling anybody where we're at. It's saying, here's the framework under which, in the future, we do research on the Oregon coast. It may be the only place that does it this way, and I think it'll be a good Oregon solution. So,
Mr. Chairman, yes.
I just noticed that we are in the presence of a distinguished alumni. Senator Vern Duncan has arrived at our committee, and that is always a red-letter day when Senator Duncan appears. So I just would like to ask the chairman to pay the respects of the Rules Committee to Senator Duncan and welcome him.
Former Senator Duncan and former Superintendent Duncan.
Former Idaho Legislator Duncan.
He's making him feel old, Joe.
And some history that I won't recall for the good of the order.
The good Senator Farioli has referred to this, the former senator on the floor already this
often.
Yes.
Mr. Chair,
well, welcome, Senator Duncan.
Mr.
Welcome.
Chair, until he arrived, I didn't realize the bill we were considering was Duncan-esque.
Oh, and then since we're on the subject, I was very pleased, on a serious note, a number of months ago to be at a groundbreaking in my district for a new school named after our esteemed colleague. Yeah.
Well, welcome, Senator Duncan.
Well deserved, actually.
Any other questions?
Okay. See another representative, Mr. Chair.
Oh, yes, Representative Boone.
I kind of, here. This is last minute. I'm sorry to miss these guys. Oh, why, thank you, sir.
You're so sorry.
Boy, Representative Roblin is full service.
Trying to rip it out. Deborah Boone, House District 32. Thank you for your indulgence. I was sitting upstairs listening to this on, and I thought, this has got to be 3106. So I'm here to support this bill and my colleagues, everything they said. Wanted to just make sure you knew there was another member in this building who strongly supports this bill for a lot of those same reasons. And this is something that we've been hoping for a long time, and we want to move forward on it. We have some future plans for field stations and research for people like Anna Pakenham in the back of the room, who just got her master's degree as a researcher, and she's now an oceanographer. And these kinds of research projects can help these students get their higher degrees and help them perform all the research that they need to do to give us the answers we need for our fisheries and habitat and ocean questions.
Any questions for Representative Boone? Seeing none.
Yes. Quick question just for clarification, Mr.
Yes.
Chair. Representative Boone, as I understand it, and I recall this from elsewhere, the Deer Shore Resources Fund, which is actually the fund that's to be established, is really the place where grants and donations would be deposited. And once you had the grants and donations, is then you would actually start forward in implementing the task force.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And some of us have some little loftier ideas, too, but that's for another session, another time. Thank you very much for consideration.
Thank you.
$0.03.
I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3106, and I will open a work session. Do we have a motion on, I believe, what are the Dash 12 amendments?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move the Dash 12 amendments to House Bill 3106.
Okay. Senator Burdick has moved the Dash 12 amendments to Senate or House Bill 3106. Any discussion? Any objection to those amendments? Seeing none, motion passes. Do we have a main motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3106 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Burdick has moved House Bill 3106 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I intend to vote no on the measure, but I do not intend to serve notice of an intent to submit a minority report.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Farioli. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Boakley?
Yes.
Senator Burdick?
Yes.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Farioli?
No.
Chair Devlin?
Aye. Motion passes. Senator Johnson will carry. Committee, with that, our work for this afternoon, notice I'm using a different word, afternoon.
Evening.
Has concluded. I've been notified that we may be required to come back in at 5 o'clock for further consideration of 2186. We also may not. So I will try to make sure that everybody knows when we're on the floor what's happening. And I will have to post, obviously, by 4 o'clock to do the 5 o'clock meeting. So with that, we're
done. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.